Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Eat Better podcast with myself, Tommy Wood, and Chloe Archard. Hi, Chloe.
Hi.
So this week we have an absolutely fabulous guest with us. We are joined by Chris Kresser. Hi, Chris.
Hi, guys. Happy to be here.
So it's a huge honor to have you on the podcast. And for those who don't know, Chris is, you know, one of the world's foremost functional medicine practitioners. He is a multi-time best-selling author. His most recent book was The Paleo Cure, which I'm sure many people listening to this will have bought and enjoyed. And he's also starting a practitioner training course, so teaching other practitioners, you know, medical doctors and other, you know, functional medical practitioners in the US particularly, but I guess also worldwide, how to use some of his methods and his approach to treating various diseases. So, Chris, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure again.
Thanks. So, I know we only have you for about 25 minutes, but obviously the question that we have to start with is, what did you have for breakfast?
Good one. Yeah, well, my wife's on a meditation retreat for 3 days, so I'm, for the first time, I'm like a solo father for 3 days for my four-year-old daughter. So I had to do everything this morning. I had to cook our breakfast and get her lunch ready for school and, you know, manage everything else that was going on. So what did I put together? We had plantain pancakes. That seemed like the easiest thing to do. So you just put some eggs in the blender with some green plantains and some baking soda and salt and a little vanilla extract and some coconut oil, blend it all up. And then make pancakes. So completely, not only gluten-free, but completely grain-free pancakes. And then we had some bacon to go with that, because you can't really have pancakes without bacon in my world.
Absolutely not. Completely agree. Sounds great. So we talked briefly before we started recording about the different models in terms of healthcare in the US versus the UK. And obviously in the UK, we're currently involved in a pitch battle over the NHS, the National Health Service, which hopefully will be around to stay for the foreseeable future. But with that, obviously people have free access to traditional medical doctors. Mm-hmm. And I'm a huge fan of that model. And I think it's something that, you know, everybody should try and replicate. But we get to a point where, you know, the expertise in traditional medicine kind of runs out. And I think a lot of people in the UK are starting to see that, particularly if they have, you know, certain chronic diseases, inflammatory diseases, metabolic diseases. And that's where, you know, the strength of your approach, you know, really, really starts to kick in. And I think people who follow you in the UK or would be, you know, get benefit from somebody who works with patients in a similar way to you in the UK. The first thing is obviously that it's not something they can get for free, so they have to change their thinking and might actually have to start paying for things. And so what I wanted to ask you is, if you had somebody, so say on a different continent where, you know, it's not the norm to start paying for tests, and they have, you know, they have some problems, some chronic problems they need to start sorting out, how would you, in the most kind of economical way, start to approach maybe testing and treating certain things, maybe the things that you see most commonly?
Well, Tommy, this is such a great question, and it's actually several questions in one, and it's something I think about a lot. And to be honest, it's not that different in the UK than it is here in that respect. What is different is you guys get coverage for basic medical care, and we don't. I mean, yeah. We kind of do in theory, but we pay for it, of course. And it's often, you know, depending on what you can afford to pay, the type of coverage that you get, even for conventional medicine, will vary a lot. But what's not very different is that most people in the States are paying for functional medicine out of pocket. So even the best sort of Cadillac version of a private, you know, health plan, a PPO, where you can select your own doctor, and they'll cover, you know, conventional testing pretty well. Like, for example, they might cover 90% of the cost of a blood test that your doctor orders, and they might cover 90% of an outpatient surgical procedure that you might need to have. And your deductible might be as low as $150. So that's like the premier kind of healthcare plan, but you could expect to pay maybe, you know, $1,700 a month for that if you've got, you know, just a family of three, for example. So, but in that plan, here's what will happen. If you go to see a functional medicine practitioner, number one, they're very likely not going to be in the network, you know, for that health insurance plan. So the percentage that they will reimburse for out-of-network services is much lower typically than in-network. So you might get, you know, 60% or 70% of that visit covered if you've got a really, really good plan, or maybe 30% of it covered if your plan isn't as good. But when that doctor starts ordering tests, if those tests are not, the labs that do those tests are not part of that insurance network, then what's very likely going to happen is they're going to be denied and the patient's going to have to pay out of pocket. So we have a lot of patients here that pay exclusively out of pocket for functional medicine services. Most functional medicine practices in the U.S. don't accept insurance even if a patient has it. They'll provide a super bill that the patient can submit to the insurance company after the fact, but the patient still has to pay up front because functional medicine practitioners here know that it's so difficult to submit anything on their end to the insurance companies, and they'll probably just deny it for the clinician. So I'd say it's pretty similar in that respect. The thing that's maybe different is that patients here don't have a national health service where they become accustomed to getting free healthcare.
Yeah,
and so there's a longer history of them paying for services, and an expectation that if they want really good services, they're going to have to pay for that. You know, there's kind of the idea, like, you know, a lot of patients here, what they do is they get what's called a catastrophic coverage plan that's pretty cheap. So if they get hit by a bus, well, God forbid they get hit by a bus, but let's say they break their arm and they have to go to the hospital, their plan will cover that after they pay a relatively high deductible. But it won't cover any other services, and they just take the money that they would have paid for a better plan in the conventional system and apply that to functional medicine, or they have what's called a health savings account where they can devote some of their pre-tax earnings and put that in a separate bank account, and then they can pay up to a certain amount. Usually it's about $6,500 a year for qualified medical expenses. So there's a lot of different ways to do it. But to get back to your question, if I have to triage and choose what the most important tests are with a patient that comes to see me, you probably won't be surprised by my answer, but I would say in many cases it would be gut testing. Uh-huh. So stool testing, breath testing, maybe urine testing to determine the health of the gut. But the real answer to your question is it depends. It totally depends on the patient. So we have, when a patient comes to see me, they fill out really, really detailed intake forms that have, you know, symptom questionnaires, detailed health history, validated surveys that help me to identify what I think some of the underlying pathologies might be that are contributing to their condition. And then based on that survey, I can then determine what the highest priorities are in terms of testing and based on their complaints. So let's say a patient comes in and they've got cold hands and feet and hair loss and thinning of the outer third of the eyebrow and constipation and tendency to gain weight. And in their diet survey, I see that they react to eggs and dairy products. And I see that their mom had hypothyroidism and their aunt has rheumatoid arthritis. I see that they have taken multiple courses of antibiotics when they were a kid for acne that they had as a teenager. I start thinking about not only hypothyroidism, but Hashimoto's, mm-hmm. given all of that clinical picture. So I would do a blood panel that screened for the tested thyroid antibodies as well as the basic thyroid workup if they hadn't already had that. Whereas somebody else comes in, they have gas and bloating and constipation and abdominal pain. They've been diagnosed with, you know, IBS, which is more or less a meaningless diagnosis, you know, just a label that's applied to a group of symptoms. Uh-huh. They've got eczema or psoriasis and skin issues and fatigue and brain fog. I'm going to be thinking breath test for SIBO, that's going to be really high on my list of priorities. So I'd say it depends on the patient. And I'd say that part of what's going to happen in the UK and elsewhere, and by the way, a number of people who've signed up for my clinician training program are from the UK.
Great.
So we have medical doctors from the UK that have signed up and other types of practitioners as well. And I think what's going to happen here is the patients are going to drive the revolution. It's going to be from the ground up. Patients are going to start demanding functional medicine, and practitioners will emerge to meet that demand. And then, like here in the U.S., you probably heard that Mark Hyman was recently tapped to open the Center for Functional Medicine at the Cleveland Clinic.
Yep.
And they just broke ground on an 18,000 square foot facility. That's a big deal because the Cleveland Clinic is one of the most prestigious medical organizations in the world, very highly regarded, and this is going to lend a lot of legitimacy to functional medicine. And, you know, that doesn't mean that we're going to wake up tomorrow and you're going to be able to go down to your, you know, NIH doctor and get a whole suite of functional medicine tests, but it does mean that there will probably be some progress in that regard, even in countries with national healthcare.
Yeah, I think it'll probably take a few years or maybe even decades in certain mm-hmm. areas for that to get going. But I think just with the amount of information we have online and the people, the people like you that the people now have access to, will hopefully really drive that.
Here's one more thing I'll say about that is I'm not holding my breath, as I'm sure you're not. It's not gonna happen overnight. But the thing that's gonna drive it forward is insurance companies. Not in the UK, but here they're for-profit companies. But even in the UK, they're concerned with maximizing. They're making it as cost efficient as possible, right? So what's gonna happen is they're gonna realize that. Let's think about someone with type 2 diabetes. By the time someone develops full-blown type 2 diabetes, it's going to cost tens of thousands of dollars to care for them. Yeah. They're going to be taking all of these super expensive drugs, and the comorbidities involved with type 2 diabetes are also costly and expensive. Risk of heart attack, retinopathy, other serious conditions goes up incredibly, and they end up spending a ton of money caring for that patient.
Yeah.
And if we're able to demonstrate, which we can very easily, and this is already being done in some pilot programs here, that if we can catch that earlier and then use diet and lifestyle primarily to intervene and prevent the progression to full-blown type 2 diabetes, believe me, they're going to pay attention to that because they're going to see that they can save tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars over the lifetime of a patient. And that's going to get their attention. So I think there's some hope there.
So you optimistically think, and I certainly don't disagree, but you don't think that the pharmaceutical industry, you're not in that kind of conspiracy theory group that thinks the pharmaceutical industry will manage to put a stop to all of that.
Oh, I think they'll try. I mean, no doubt. But I don't know that they'll be able to completely. If the powers saving hundreds of thousands of dollars is a pretty compelling for one single patient is a pretty compelling proposition. And like this project that Rob Wolf has been involved with in Reno, where they saved the city of Reno millions, if not tens of millions of dollars. I don't remember the exact figure, but they were working with municipal employees like firefighters and police force and other, city employees. And they did exactly what I'm saying. These people were all on statins and metformin, metabolic drugs. They were, and if one of them has a heart attack at like age 55, they basically, the city pays for their care for the rest of their life. They become disabled and the city has to spend, lots and lots of money, tens or hundreds of thousands over the lifetime of that employee due to their, healthcare and pension plan.
Yeah.
So what the project that Rob was doing, they basically created some fairly straightforward algorithms. They did, lipid testing, metabolic testing. They put them on a low carb paleo type of diet, some other interventions, and what do you know? That in many cases their blood sugar issues were reversed. Everyone became a lot healthier. The rates of disease went down tremendously. The city of Reno saved millions of dollars, and they were, you know, it's a hugely successful project. It's now being kind of exported to other places, and there's nothing the pharmaceutical companies could do about that. You know, they're powerless in the face of that. So there is some hope.
Very exciting.
Yeah.
Chloe and I, the things that we've talked about previously, are often based around a paleo style diet, paleo style lifestyle. But, you know, maybe we talk about some of the evidence where things that are strictly, you know, taken out of a traditional paleo diet, like dairy or, you know, legumes or some grains, you know, where actually maybe we shouldn't be so worried about those things. And a lot of that has been driven by a lot of the research that you've done. So what I'd be really interested to hear is your thoughts on what other things maybe you see people in the paleo world, maybe the low carb world, the kind of things that they're talking about and focusing on that maybe, you know, it isn't really worth worrying about, or that they can maybe focus their attention elsewhere, you know, sort of like the evolution of the next kind of stage of that sort of ancestral health, both diets and lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'll start with a general answer to that, which is that I think in many cases, people become too focused on diet, period.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's paleo diet or any other kind of diet. And there's no question that diet is the most important starting place for most people, and possibly everybody. But there's so many other things that influence our health. And the more I do this work, the more important those things seem to me. You know, I've told various stories before. I'm not sure how many your listeners are familiar with, but I'm going to tell one. Hopefully people haven't heard it and they're not going to be rolling their eyes when I start telling this again. But so back when I was studying medicine, I was interning with a doctor who specialized in treating chronically ill people. And we had this one patient who was just really sick. He was a young guy. He was probably in his early 20s, but he was emaciated and you know, really dark circles under his eyes and really, really sick. And he just kept removing more and more foods from his diet to the point where at the end of the, you know, the time when we were seeing him, he was eating like broccoli and skinless, boneless, skinless chicken breast and quinoa, I think. And he disappeared for about 6 months. Like the last time we saw him, he looked like he was on death's door. And we didn't see him for a while, 6 to 9 months, I think it was. And then he came back and walked in the door, and literally I didn't even recognize him at first. I was like, you know, who's this new patient? And then it was double take, and we looked at him, and he had, you know, gained 30 pounds, 34, 35 pounds. His face was like, he got all his color back, no more dark circles under his eyes, just seemed like a different person entirely. And the doctor asked him, oh, you know, what happened? What, you know, tell us about this transformation. It's incredible. Was it the anti-candida diet? Was it the, you know, I don't even remember what the diets were at that point. They were different than they are now, because this was a while ago.
Yeah.
Was it macrobiotics?
Yep.
And he said, nope, it was the beer and pizza diet. And basically, he had gotten to the point where he was, you know, he was suicidal, and he was like, you know, if I'm going to go out, I'm just at least going to just, for, you know, like have some fun for a while and just forget about all of this stuff. And so he started just going out with his friends, eating pizza, drinking beer. You know, prior to that, he had been so isolated with his diet that he was not spending any time with his friends. His relationship with his girlfriend ended. You know, she was not willing to hang around with him through that. And he was really depressed, and he wasn't able to work. And, you know, so he had no life, essentially.
Yeah.
And then when he added those things back in, he started to feel tremendously better. And, you know, he was hanging out with his friends and had a social life and was able to find work, and, you know, his whole life changed. So that's a really extreme example. In most cases, you know, like for someone, if they have celiac or gluten intolerance, the beer and pizza diet is definitely not a good idea. so don't get me wrong. But I think it makes a point, which is that there are a lot of things that influence our health. Like I said, diet is one, and it's probably one of the most, you know, the most important or one of the most important. But the other things are, of course, everyone also thinks of exercise and sleep and stress management, and those are absolutely crucial. And in many cases, they're even more important than diet. So for a patient might come to me and, you know, they're on like, most of my patients are like crazy sophisticated with this stuff. You know, they've been following my work for a long time. They know a lot about it. They're on like autoimmune paleo with like low FODMAP modifications and also histamine intolerant, you know, low histamine. They've got the diet totally wired, you know, but they're not doing any kind of meditation or mindfulness practice or anything to manage their stress. And what I'm not going to sit there with that person and try to tweak the last, you know, 1.5% of their diet to get it right.
Yeah.
I'm going to focus on stress management with that patient. I'm going to ask them about social connections in their life. Do they have friends and people that they have meaningful conversations with and they get support from? Do they play? Do they experience pleasure in their life? Do they, you know, do things that actually release endorphins, you know, whether it's getting a massage or acupuncture or having sex or taking a hot bath or, listening to music that moves them? Like, these things are not, they don't have an imaginary effect on our health. They're not like, oh, that's nice if you have that time for that. It's they have a real measurable impact where you can, you know, they've done, there's so many studies about this where you can actually measure the release of endorphins and oxytocin. And we know so much more now about how endorphins affect our health. They regulate, they promote T regulatory cell function, and the Tregs really balance our immune system. So they can directly impact autoimmune disease or immune deficiency. I could go on and on, but that's a rather long-winded answer to your question, which is don't get too hung up on diet. There's even a term now, as I'm sure you know, orthorexia, which describes almost an addiction to special diets and special ways of eating. So the second thing, more specifically about diet, you mentioned it. You know, I've been a longtime proponent of what I've called the paleo template. And my book was originally called Your Personal Paleo Code because I even, you know, and I even hesitated to include the term paleo in my book. And I've been attacked by certain paleo purists and advocates for using the term paleo, because what I recommend, you know, they argue that what I recommend is not paleo.
Yeah.
And they're right. It's not. Unfortunately, you know, the paleo is I think of it as kind of a loose term, you know, to describe an approach that where there's some leeway and flexibility. And I explain that in my book. And it's a lot easier for people to just say paleo and recognize the term paleo than, you know, nutrient dense real food diet, which is was the other alternative for a book title. It didn't seem as catchy. So yeah, I've written an article about legumes where I argue that I think legumes, if they're well tolerated by the individual, can be a healthy part of the diet, especially now that we know what we know about resistant starch and how important it is for feeding beneficial gut bacteria. And I don't think that the paleo argument against legumes is very strong or has much support in the scientific literature. And then dairy, I feel the same way about that too. You know, it's true that our paleo ancestors didn't consume dairy, but it's also true that there have been some significant genetic changes in the last 10,000 years. And one of those changes was a mutation that allowed some humans to be able to digest lactose, which is the sugar in milk, as adults. Whereas prior to that, we were only able to digest it from breast milk when we were breastfeeding.
Yeah.
And now about a third of the global population is lactose tolerant and able to tolerate lactose. And when you look at the scientific studies on dairy products. Full fat dairy is associated with lower risk of cardiovascular disease, lower risk of obesity, and lower risk of metabolic disease. So and other health benefits. So if you just, you know, if you had no dog in this fight, you had no idea about paleo, no preconceived notions, and you went into the scientific literature and you looked at the studies on dairy and its relation to health, you would find that full fat dairy is a healthy and beneficial food.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't mean everyone can tolerate it, but if they can, I don't have a problem with it.
I think that's a really good point. You know, it's a very good place to start from. Sort of, I know you talk about the evolutionary perspective. The evolutionary lens is very useful when you're looking at this kind of stuff. But, you know, we also have a huge amount of scientific evidence that we can also draw from, which doesn't necessarily always go directly with the preconceived notions of what that involves.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think the easiest way to explain it is I think of paleo as an elimination diet. So, you know, strict paleo. I mean, so you do it for 30 days, which I advocated for in my book. And then you can add some of these, what I call gray area foods, like legumes and dairy and alcohol and dark chocolate and things that our ancestors weren't eating a lot of. But that actually, if you look at the research, that they're either benign or beneficial. So you add them back in and you see how you tolerate them, and then you create your own kind of customized version of a paleo template type of diet. Now, having said that, some people just might feel better on a strict paleo diet, and then when they try to add those foods back in, they feel worse, and they end up doing that for the rest of their life, and that's perfectly fine too, because humans did that for, you know, hundreds of generations. So
absolutely.
No problem.
Kind of running out of time now. I did have a couple of questions, but we wanted to also talk to you because you are coming to the UK pretty soon, actually. It's the end of this month give a two-day event, sort of two separate day events. So we wanted to just mention that in case any of our listeners hadn't heard about that yet. And we wondered if you could just tell everyone a little bit about the two different day events that you're doing and what will be covered in both of those days.
Sure, but I don't think it's fair that Tommy got to ask all the questions, so I'm going to let you ask at least one before I tell everyone about the events.
Okay. My question was just going back, actually. When you were talking about when people come to see you, one of the most important tests you would do is gut testing, maybe stool testing or urine testing. Because it's my favorite topic of conversation at the moment, the gut microbiome. And a lot of the stuff I've read has talked about paleo, and particularly if people are doing a sort of low-carb approach to paleo, that could actually be detrimental to the gut microbiota. Yeah. And I know you don't advocate a low-carb approach, but I think still a lot of people are perhaps eating quite a low-carb paleo diet, and even if they're not eating low-carb, maybe eating quite low-fiber or the specific types of fiber, like you mentioned, the resistant starch, the specific types of fiber that feed the gut bacteria. And I just wondered if you had seen from your testing any evidence of whether a paleo diet is, if someone comes in with some sort of gut dysbiosis and they do change their diet, are you seeing like really positive results in what their subsequent gut testing shows?
Absolutely. Yeah. Several questions there too, and all important ones. So first of all, there is some research that suggests that a very low carb diet does have an adverse effect on the gut microbiome. And it's not very hard to understand when you understand the mechanism of how bacteria, you know, what bacteria feed on. They feed on carbohydrates, and they feed on what we call microbiota accessible carbohydrates, or MACs. That's probably the best definition I've heard that was coined by Justin, a microbiologist named Justin Sonneberg at Stanford. And these are carbohydrates that are not, you know, with things, carbohydrates like glucose and fructose, we human beings are able to absorb those in the small intestine, and then we convert them into usable energy, ATP in the cell, glucose, And so they're carbohydrates that we can absorb, but there are a lot of carbohydrates that we can't absorb and convert into energy. And these don't get digested at all, and they just pass all the way through the small intestine into the large intestine. But that's where the bacteria absorb them, and when the or metabolize them. And as they do that, the bacteria will multiply. So if you follow a diet that is low in those microbiota accessible carbohydrates, as a very low carb diet would inevitably be, then you can have over time, I think that can deplete the beneficial gut bacteria. Now, I do think that there are, I wouldn't say I'm not an advocate of a low carb diet. I'd say I'm not an advocate of a low carb diet for everybody. I think it can be extremely helpful with epilepsy and neurological conditions and for rapid weight loss and in other situations. But the idea that everyone should just by default be on a really low carb diet is something that I'm not an advocate of. And this is one of the big reasons. And, you know, when people come in and they follow a low carb diet and I do stool testing, the stool testing that I do quantifies beneficial bacteria at the species and genus level. So I'm able to see get a rough idea of what those are. And then after I make my recommendations, which often would involve, we treat their gut pathologies, and then I do suggest that they add microbiota accessible carbohydrates back into their diet, then we retest with the stool testing and we see the increase in those beneficial species. So yes, we definitely see that, and it's an issue that I've talked to Jeff Leach about. He runs
Human Food Project.
Exactly, and American Gut, which is one of the labs that you can get your entire your gut microbiome sequenced through by sending a stool sample. And he's told me, I had him on my podcast and we talked about this, that, anecdotally, he hasn't done any rigorous study on this, but he's seen that depletions in beneficial species on the tests, American gut tests, in people who are following very low carb diets.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting to see what I think. There's the eubiome testing that you can have done now, which Tommy and I have talked about a couple of times, and I've submitted two samples to eubiome, one of which I've had back and one of which I'm waiting to have back, but I think that's starting to become more readily available for people, and so I think over the next couple of years there'll be more and more coming out where people are doing their own testing and sort of looking at actually what is going on based on what sort of diet they're eating.
Exactly.
So it'll be really interesting to see.
The one caveat I have to add to that is I think we're in the kind of on the frontier of all of this, and we still don't fully understand how to interpret the results of these tests and put them to clinical use. So, an example of how confusing it can be is when Jeff has been living with the Hadza hunter-gatherers, which is probably the last truly Paleolithic group of people on Earth, and tested their stool, I believe he found that the levels of bifidobacteria, which are typically considered to be, very, very beneficial species and in the Western population, were almost non-existent in that population. And yet they have no evidence of chronic modern inflammatory disease. So it may be that the ideal microbiome for me is different than for you, which is, again, different for someone living in China or someone living in South Africa. So I'm just a little concerned about how these tests are being used and to make clinical decisions at this point, because I think that may be a little premature. I think there's certain general conclusions that we can come to, but we need to, be cautious.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. All right, should we talk about the events?
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Okay. So, yeah, I'm really excited to come to the UK. I've actually never been to the UK. I've spent a lot of my 20s traveling all over the world and have been most, Europe, South Africa, Asia, Southeast Asia, South America, Central America. I never made it to the UK in all that time. So this is my first trip and I'm excited about that. And I'm excited about these events because I never, obviously never taught over in the UK. So the first one is on Saturday, and it's going to be an event for the general public. And, you know, the loose topic will be ancestral nutrition and health. But what I've found in doing a lot of these events now is that it's really much better, more fun for everyone in the room, more valuable and more fun for me to not plan the agenda too closely. What I like to do is start off by asking people what their experience and knowledge level is, get a sense of who's in the room, and then I'll ask people what their burning questions are, topics that they really want me to cover, and write those up on a whiteboard. And then I have a lot of material, of course, from all the talks I've done over the years that I can intersperse and move around. And then we just go through all those topics, and there are inevitably are questions about those, and that it ends up being a really rich and great learning experience and fun day. So that's the general public day. Fantastic. And then on Sunday I'm doing an event for clinicians, or that's oriented towards clinicians. It's anybody is welcome, but the level of the discussion will be at the clinical level. So people who are totally new to this might be a little lost if they came to that, but if someone in the general public who just loves this stuff and has been following it for years, they might actually get a lot out of that that event. So I'm going to share exclusive material that's from my clinician training program. I'm going to present a systems model for functional medicine that I've developed in my own practice and as a teaching tool. I'm going to talk about the 8 core pathologies that I think underlie all chronic multi-system, multi-symptom illness. I'm going to talk about how to structure and layer a treatment effectively. And just as with the public event, I'm going to ask people what they really want to talk about, you know, everything from which lab tests that I use and prefer, how to interpret them, what kind of treatment protocols I do. I'm, you know, really going to just be available to answer any questions that people have. So I know that we've had a really great response so far, and people coming from Scandinavia, Northern Europe, and over from the continent, and from, of course, the UK as well. So I can't wait to meet everyone. I'm looking forward to doing it.
Yeah, I think, I imagine there's a number of people listening to this who I know are coming and are really looking forward to it, and rightly so. I think it's going to be absolutely fantastic. And I'm certain that Chloe will turn up with her Ubiome result in her hand to ask for a personal consult. So those will be Saturday the 31st of October and Sunday the 1st of November. Tickets can be found at refindhealth.com. That's re-findhealth.com. And I'll also put links to this in the show notes on drragnar.com. But Chris, I mean, it's been a huge pleasure to have you. Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for the invitation. I had a great time. Hopefully I just didn't talk your ear off too much, and I look forward to meeting you both when I come over to the UK.
Yeah, absolutely. No,
I'm really looking forward to it.
And I would say it's normally Chloe getting her ear talked off by me, so she's probably it's nice to get a different voice.
All right, great. Well, yeah, but I'll see you not too long. I guess we're only a few weeks away, so I'll come prepared for what should I come prepared for? End of October, rain, fog, damp, cold weather.
Yeah, probably. But you never know. You might get lucky and bring some sunshine with you. But prepare for.
I'm gonna try to do that because I'm looking out my window and it's about 70 degrees and sunny here in California. So I'm gonna pack that in my suitcase.
Yeah. Thanks very much for letting us know about that.
All right. All right. Talk to you soon, guys. Thanks. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.